Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Later in the program, our roundtable. But first, joining us today are Michael Baer, the former chairman of the Defense Business Board and the president of the Dumbarton Strategies Consultancy, and Arnold Panaro, a former staff director of the Senate Armed Services Committee, who is now chairman of the Panaro Group Consultancy and the chairman of the National Defense Industrial Association. Both of these gentlemen have played key roles in presidential defense transitions for many decades. Michael and Arnold, welcome back to the program.
Good to be back.
Great to be back, Vago.
And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy, and Beretta USA, our land warfare coverage. Arnold, start us off. Lloyd Austin is defense secretary. He's now got a week under his belt, roughly. Tony Blinken also confirmed at State. Janet Yellen, obviously, at Treasury. Others to follow. Where do we stand, though, with Kath Hicks as deputy? And when is the administration going to release the names of all the assistant secretaries, right, in the 13 Senate confirmable positions and 66 political appointees that are in the department? I mean, where do we stand in the process of standing up this administration?
Well, Vago, let me start by telling all your listeners that today our nation pays its final respects to one of the great statesmen of our time, General Bent Scowcroft, who will be buried today at Arlington Cemetery with full military honors. You and Michael and I had the privilege of knowing and working with General Scowcroft over the years, and he's the gold standard for how this administration, this Congress, and people that aspire to be leaders in national security should approach it on a nonpartisan, objective basis. So a great statesman, a great American, appropriately honored at Arlington Cemetery today. In terms of where we are, Lloyd Austin, of course, is basically on the job as Secretary of Defense, confirmed by the Senate and waived by the Senate and House. And obviously, they're turning their attention to the budget. So what we're going to be looking at on the budget is a flat budget with no inflation, meaning at us, for starters, they've got to take out over $100 billion in the FYDP. Obviously, we're not going to see the full details in early February, like is tradition. But I think we'll see OMB send up general top line numbers in late March with budget details to follow in late April. Also, Kath Hicks has her confirmation hearing before the Senate Armed Services Committee next Tuesday. We certainly urge the Senate to move expeditiously on getting her confirmed. She will be a key player along with Susanna Bloom, who is the director of CAPE now acting in terms of preparing the Pentagon's adjustments to the Trump budget. We also, as you indicated, only have one other nominee currently pending for Undersecretary of Policy. So of the 61 required Senate confirmed positions, one confirmed and two in the hopper. I think we won't see the additional names until Kath Hicks is confirmed and on board, which I hope is no later than the end of next week, so that the deputy basically can help move that process along. As you mentioned, of course, we have key players that will affect the Department of Defense's activities at the State Department, obviously at Treasury, but also OMB. Neera Tanden is not confirmed yet at OMB, although they've named the Associate Director for National Security. They will have a huge say-so in the top line. My belief is that that will be an arm wrestle between the Deputy Secretary of Defense and the people at OMB. So Austin also has underway a series of reviews, the nuclear posture review, the National Defense Strategy Review. I'm sure they're looking in great detail at some of the decisions that were made personnel-wise towards the end of the Trump administration, and announced they're reviewing those as well. So they're just getting cranked up. They've got a huge agenda ahead of them, and we desperately need to get these additional Senate-confirmed people on board. Over.
And I should point out that you both were caught up in that, both on the Defense Business Board and other boards. At the end of that, as many people were lost jobs, and that decision obviously is being reconsidered by Secretary Austin. Michael, give us your sense on this as well, and what do you think some of the key factors are going to be.
Well, Vago, Arnold gave us a great run through. Let me just add a couple of things. First is, as he said, we're on day nine. There are 465 days left until the midterm. And Austin has only two of his 60 appointees nominated. However, they have installed dozens of very talented people as chiefs of staff and special assistants to reinforce the career individuals or holdovers in acting roles and performing the duty of roles. But if I look to Austin, I think he's off to a very good start. And though it's early, he seems to be living a very famous set of advice that King George gave to his son-in-law, Philip. And that was, never forget that she is the soul of your duty. And in this case, the she for Austin is the president. And the president is the soul of his duty. And the last 10 secretaries of defense often forgot that in the early days. Austin, in contrast, is using his first weeks to check off each and every one of his promises to the president and to the Senate. So I regard that as a very good start, but there is an enormous amount of work to do, and he is exceedingly shorthanded. Over.
Right. I mean, well, this is the thing, right? I mean, you know, it's every time you have a new president, there's a tendency to laud. It's also worth remembering, right? We're in the first couple of innings of the first game. There are 162 games in the season, not to wear out a baseball analogy on this. Arnold, there is a change in the balance of power if you're a Washington ologist on this sort of thing. The Pentagon is obviously a power base and spent decades as sort of the prime mover, right, of foreign policy even, right? The policy staff at the Pentagon is bigger than the policy planning staff at the State Department. This administration has made it abundantly clear that the State Department will be in the lead, which is actually historically correct. The Pentagon is in a supportive capacity in this case. And the powerhouse team at the National Security Council and at the White House suggests that this relationship is going to be fundamentally different. You've got Jake Sullivan. You have Tony Blinken, who are both extremely close to the president. You've got Liz Sherwood Randall, who's close to the president, Kurt Campbell, Fiona Hill, other enormous heavyweights. What does this dynamic mean for the traditional relationships in Washington, D.C., and the role of DOD in it, the role of state, and the incredible centrality that the White House will play in this, which folks would say is normal and right?
Well, Vago, I think I would argue this is a plus, not a minus. And that's because you have in these individuals, first starting with the president, who spent 36 years on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, working for my boss, Senator Nunn, privileged to overlap 24 years. He was very involved in all national security decision makings. Many of his key staff came off of the Senate staff. These are highly experienced, quite capable individuals. They've been in government before. Some of the ones you mentioned, obviously Secretary of State Blinken, Wendy Sherman, who's nominated to be the deputy, Brian McKeon, who's nominated to be the third most important person at state. You've named the powerhouse at the NSC, but like Kurt Campbell, these are people with immense expertise. Fiona Hill for Russia, Liz Sherwood Randall for Homeland. This is a real plus because they're bringing in individuals that have a track record, that are battle tested, that understand national security, and frankly, have traditionally approached it in a bipartisan fashion along the lines of Brent Scowcroft. And also, former Secretary Mattis gave a talk yesterday where he talked about the fact that we need to basically have our State Department and diplomacy out front. So I think the Department of Defense, obviously the world's largest, most complex organization, certainly will retain great influence and power and be a key participant. But again, the right balance at this point in our history, we've got to rebuild relationships. We've got to regain respect for our country overseas. We've got to strengthen our partnerships and alliances. We've got to basically look more to soft power. To get on top of the climate crisis, we need to work with other countries. This is going to be the lead role, you know, more on the diplomatic side than on the military side. So frankly, in my view, I see this as a real plus and not a minus. Over.
Michael?
Vago, the oldest saying in Washington is that people are policy. And what we're seeing here is that the policy intentions and aspirations of the president are being built out in real detail, not only at state and OMB, as Arnold mentioned, but also at the Department of Defense. This team in the at the National Security Council are not the 450 junior staffers that drove the Pentagon crazy with their cacophony before. These are, as Arnold said, highly skilled operators who've known each other and trust each other and have worked together. They've also known and worked and trusted with the people who were installed in the policy and deputy secretary's offices and the possibly CAPE and so on throughout the Department of Defense. So what we're seeing here is a remarkable, and in my time, I've never seen it quite this level of really well-connected, centrally focused manifestation of presidential ambition. So this is really going to be worth watching closely.
It certainly will, and we look forward to covering them very closely. And to play off on that first statement, Arnold, you made, you know, General Scowcroft was an inspiration intellectually, personally, to so many, was just an incredible mentor, fostered new generations of talent, and his decency and honesty were things that really should serve, as you said, sort of, you know, were just a guiding light. And so we, you know, express our deepest condolences again to the Scowcroft family. Gentlemen, thanks very, very much. Really appreciate it and look forward to having you guys back on next week. Have a great weekend.
Our privilege, Vago.
Always a pleasure, Vago.
And joining us for our roundtable to discuss the week in Washington are Dr. Gordon Adams, a fellow at the Quincy Institute and the Stimson Center, who is also a professor emeritus at American University, Byron Callen of the independent Washington research firm Capital Alpha Partners, Dr. Patrick Cronin of the Hudson Institute, Todd Harrison of the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and Dr. Dov Zakheim, former Pentagon comptroller, who is also a senior advisor at CSIS. Normally, we start off with budget and all of that. We'll get to that in a minute. But first, I want to start off. Patrick, start us off. President of the United States has had a busy week, engaged with many international leaders, had a what was characterized as a candid conversation laying out U.S. Complaints with Russia, with Vladimir Putin, everything from the SolarWinds attack to allegations of Russian bounties on Americans in Afghanistan, raising Navalny, raising election interference, and with also engaging and delivering messages to China, whether it's to come to the Philippines defense, to continue arming Taiwan, Taiwanese ambassador being at the inauguration, which didn't sit well with China, and then delivering the message, before we engage more deeply with you, we want to talk to our allies and partners about what a strategy should be diplomatically, economically, and on security. And then I want to get everybody's take on this also, a different message to the Middle East, both supportive of the Abraham Accords, but charting a little bit of a different course. Start us off, Patrick. I mean, what did some of these messages mean, right? For some, it's very encouraging for a tough new president. For others, it's very wait and see. It's still the, you know, we're still in the first game of 162 game season.
Well, Vago, 10 days into the administration, still dealing with a pandemic that's raging here and with political discord, the Biden administration has done a good job of saying we're back internationally. And I think that is a welcome message to almost everybody around the country, less so perhaps to Moscow and Beijing than our allies and partners. But even to Beijing and Moscow, the Biden administration had words saying we want strategic cooperation where it matters. But the Biden administration is going to rebuild at home. And Tony Blinken, the new Secretary of State, has made no bones about saying this is to compete and outcompete China. We're going to deter mischief abroad and conflict abroad. And this is a message for Russia and China and others. And we're going to do this that in a way that respects not just U.S. interests, but also our values. And here, most importantly, the Biden administration has underscored the importance of working with allies and partners to reform and preserve the system and the rules of the road. And that's the main message. That's why the Biden administration has reached out to allies in Europe, the Middle East, and Asia. And in Asia, I think the overall message here, Vago, is you could, if this were a movie, you might call this the sequel to The Pivot, or Rebalance to Asia, with the subtitle, This Time We Mean It. Making sure that Japan, South Korea, Australia, India, even the Philippines feel like the United States has their back is very important. China's welcome, though, as I wrote this week in Foreign Policy with Bob Manning, was rather strange, indicating that any reset of U.S.-China relations were going to happen on Xi's terms, not U.S. terms. So they're testing the Biden administration, trying to keep it off balance. And the biggest challenge this past 10 days has been over Taiwan. After the de facto ambassador to Taiwan, Xiaobi Kim, attended the inauguration, Beijing was quick to buzz the air defense identification zone around Taiwan, actually simulating attacks on the Teddy Roosevelt aircraft carrier, and declaring that independence means war. Understatement is back in the U.S. government, though. Admiral Kirby, the defense press secretary, said that independence means war is an unfortunate term. Peter Jennings, who heads up Australia's leading defense think tank, has predicted that 2021 could see a clash over Taiwan as China under Xi presses its revisionist agenda and tries to hem us in to making a mistake or backing off Taiwan so China can muscle its way further in. So we have a real problem with dealing with China's strategy and Xi Jinping. And here I would just mention one reading that everybody should be looking at this week is an article that was in Politico, politico.com, on China's strategy for the Biden administration. It's a lengthy document. It's very powerful, and its author is anonymous. Over to you.
And just for our audience, Fred Kemp, the CEO, president and CEO of the Atlantic Council, will be joining us for our strategy conversation tomorrow, in which he discusses this longer telegram by Anonymous, talking about what a strategy looks like, sort of mirroring the 1946 George Kennan telegram from London, from Moscow. Gordon, you taught international relations. How did you see all of this, the messaging around it, and play a little bit off of what Patrick just said, right? Because the biggest fear was that China was going to test everybody in Asia over Taiwan. And it looks like, you know, right, having, you know, crushed Hong Kong, the next priority item is Taiwan on the Chinese list of things that they will sort out by force if necessary.
Well, before we start going to war with Taiwan or war with China over Taiwan, let's step back just a bit. We're in early innings here still, but very clearly the attitude and the organization and the focus that the Biden administration is trying to communicate is the grown-ups who are organized and coherent are back in charge. I had the opportunity on Friday to sit in on a session that Jake Sullivan did with Robert O'Brien for the U.S. Institute of Peace. And he very articulately described a quite sophisticated array of thinking that was going on in the Biden administration about how to engage both Russia and China. It's very clear that Russia and China were top of the pile, and that's perfectly appropriate. And he was quite clear about what he and the president were pushing forward with respect to the Russians and what they were prepared to advance with the Russians in a direction of more cooperation. Particularly striking was the proposal to renew the New START agreement for another 5 years, which was accepted by the Russians and ratified by the Duma and signed by Putin last week. So it is a ship moving forward in a much more coherent and organized manner with respect to Russia. With respect to China, very clearly, Sullivan was making it clear that this is the centerpiece. This is what the big challenge that the United States has to get its arms around and figure out how to do it. And what's interesting there, and this reinforces what Patrick was saying, the focus on alliances, the focus on reaching out to people in the Pacific theater. Sullivan made the point of saying the Quad is something they're going to carry forward, Japan, Australia, US, India, as a set of consultations and messages that they want to make clear to China. Allies and partners are going to be at the forefront of this. So they are, in both senses, focusing on being coherent and organized and both subtle and sophisticated in the way they approach it. The pivot to Asia that Patrick mentioned is very clear, if only in the rather dramatic restructuring of the heft in the National Security Council staff that Sullivan has made, that he's built quite an Asian focus and Asian capability under the stewardship of Kurt Campbell, who knows what he's talking about when it's relationships in Asia and with China. So there's very, very clearly a strong and coherent focus. The jury is out on exactly how this plays out. It has to be. We're only 10 days in.
And I should also point out Fiona Hill, who was in the Trump administration, is now the Russia director on the National Security Council, another one of the extraordinary minds the nation has on Russia. Dov, give us your sense both on China and Russia, but also what some of the changes the administration is making in the Middle East, right, in terms of F-35s and precision weapons to our Gulf allies, United Arab Emirates in particular, but also the change in language, right? Supportive of the Abraham Accords, but at the same time underscoring something different while accepting the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem.
Well, everything is actually connected. Gordon, who, by the way, was a professor of mine in international relations many years ago, longer than either of us will admit. The National Security Council has actually moved people from the Middle East shop. And as the Asia shop has grown, the Middle East shop has shrunk. You also have a bunch of people who are not considered friends of Putin, not just in the White House, but you've got Victoria Nuland, for example, who is very hardline, and the Russians were very unhappy that she will now be the number three person in the State Department. But the administration is clearly carrying its, you might want to say, Trump administration plus. That is to say, the priorities stay the same, but the methodology, the way the president has handled himself, and of course, being very clear with Mr. Putin about issues that Mr. Putin does not want to hear about, Navalny and many other things. And the human rights issues, of course, extend beyond Russia and beyond China to the Middle East, which is why the F-35 sale to the UAE and the sales to Saudi Arabia are in such jeopardy. It's because of human rights. And so you're seeing a certain degree of consistency there in the case of even the Palestinians. The Jerusalem embassy will stay put, but the consulate that was for the Palestinians in Jerusalem is being reopened, which is to say that unlike what happened in the past 4 years, there's a recognition on the part of this administration that the Palestinians have a case. They may not be ready to deal with the Israelis. They're doing all sorts of things that are in many cases horrible, but they are a people, they have a case, and they should be considered. And so this is a different approach, no fancy peace processes per se, but a recognition that one has to take account of both sides. So I would give these folks in the first 10 days some pretty good marks. Let's see where they go from here, but they've already laid down some very important markers.
Let me just push you a little bit on F-35 very briefly though, right? Potentially problematic when, given how close an ally the United Arab Emirates is, and the expectation they had in striking the Abraham Accords was they would get the F-35, something they've sought for some years.
Yeah, absolutely right. The Emirates have been a very, very close ally, probably in many ways the most reliable ally we have in the Gulf, were and still are that way. They have actually pulled out of Yemen to a degree that the Saudis have not, so that's another factor. And yes, the clear understanding was that as part of this arrangement with the Israelis, the Abraham Accord, they would get the F-35s. And the Prime Minister of Israel, Netanyahu, pretty much hinted as much. And so would the United States pull back from the deal? You just don't know whether that, how that'll affect the Accords. They are saying they want to study the problem. Good, let them study it. But the conclusion should be the same. Continue with the sale.
Byron, give us your sense on this and how you see it and the messaging and how that you see it in a more integrated fashion, perhaps.
Well, I think the two points just to add, and I agree with what's been said. Look, if you rank order the calls that Secretary of Defense Austin has made and the readouts and the dates that these calls are made, you know, I think it's a pretty interesting list. NATO was first at Secretary Stoltenberg, then to the UK, then Japan. Those two calls are on the 23rd, and Korea as well on the 23rd. Then Canada and Australia on the 26th, India on the 27th, as well as Germany on the 27th, and then France on the 28th, and Israel on the 28th. So missing in that list, and maybe not too surprising given the reviews underway for major weapon sales, are Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates. Where that goes in the future, I expect the sales will ultimately go through to the Emiratis. The idea of offensive weapon systems, Raytheon announced they were writing off an inventory of weapons that must have been special built for the Saudis. So that might indicate where their thinking is. And the other call that I think stands out, and I think actually Patrick may have even commented on this, was a call that Secretary of State Blinken made to the Philippine Secretary of Foreign Affairs on the 27th. And I think that's another key linchpin. As much as we focus on Taiwan, Japan, Korea, I mean, if you think about this whole concept of archipelagic defense, Philippines is absolutely front and center of that. And it's important that we maintain a close relationship with the Philippines, as much as we may have some fairly strong differences with its leader.
Todd, what's your sense on this? And what are the potential implications industrially, especially for FMS from your standpoint? But you can talk to us about the broad, right? I mean, because it'll be puts and takes if we're going to be selling more to Taiwan, right? But what's your sort of sense on the messaging and what the implications are?
Yeah, you know, we kind of expected this, right? That there's going to be a pullback and a bit more scrutiny on foreign military sales, particularly in the Middle East. You know, the Trump administration had just opened up the spigot wide and was pushing as hard as it could to sell just about anything to just about anyone. That's not going to continue. And we're going to see the Biden administration take a more careful look, you know, not just on who they're selling to, but what they're selling and how that affects the qualitative, you know, military balance in these different regions. And so these things are going to get a lot more scrutiny. They're going to take longer. So we should not expect to see as much. You know, with that said, though, where we may see a bit more emphasis being placed in foreign military sales is in the Asia Pacific region, because, you know, I think that will continue to be at the forefront of, you know, national security planning and considerations, especially about how do we work more effectively with our allies and partners in the region.
I want to kind of go around the horn really quickly now and transition to budget. And Todd, maybe let's pick up with you and then kind of quickly go around the horn on what it all means. You know, the administration is working its budget. We had an expectation that something would be out in February, right around the middle of the month, which historically we see a new administration sort of give a sense on where we are. But now it looks like that's not going to be until April. And effectively, it looks like we're going to have a flat budget, as we've been discussing here for a very long time, that is actually going to be a cut, right? Because it's not going to include money for inflation. At the top of the show, we heard from Arnold Panaro, and he said that it could come out to about $100 billion cut over the course of the future year's defense plan. Talk to us about the stimulus, the budget, right? Where are we? Where are we likely to go? How does climate change things? How does nuclear play into this debate? Sort of give us your sense, given that the administration is now doing some hard math crunching, if it's going to have something ready for prime time for Congress in April.
Well, how long do we have? No. let me start with kind of the timing. You know, it is normal that the first budget request of a new administration will be delayed probably till April, maybe May. You know, and what I'm hearing from folks is that, you know, not only was there not a smooth transition, there wasn't much of a transition when it came to some of these matters. So, yeah, it might take a little bit longer. Now, we could see some top line numbers, a skinny budget, if you will, come out from OMB before that. But, you know, that would just be telling us, all right, what's the top line for national defense or DOD? Not any details in that. The details will not come out till like April or May. Now, you know, considering what that's going to be, what we're going to see in the five-year projection, it's important to remember the baseline that we're starting from. What is this all going to be referenced to? And that's really what the Trump administration had been planning for and projecting. And so the Trump administration, OMB, actually came out in December, unusually, with its top line numbers that it was planning for in the FY22 budget request. And the five-year period out to FY26. And that showed a defense top line that was flat with inflation over that five-year period. So flat, but slightly growing with inflation. So that's where we're starting from, right? And, you know, personally, I don't think that the Biden administration is going to be inclined to propose any significant cuts from that right now. And so I expect to see that the top line stays fairly close to that. We could see maybe a slight reduction. I'm not expecting to see something like $100 billion taken out of the budget over 5 years. But, you know, that will just be their first projection, right? What's actually going to happen, though, over the next 5 years could be a very different story. It depends on Congress. It depends on the midterm elections in 2022. And specifically, I think it depends on how quickly and how much does the Republican Party swing towards, you know, fiscal conservatism and wanting to cut back on government spending and cut back on the deficit. If that happens, and the sooner it happens, the bigger impact that I think that will ultimately have on the defense budget. But right now, I think the Biden administration is not, you know, in a position to want to cut spending at all, given our economic situation. And, you know, I don't think this is a fight that they would want to pick with Republicans on the Hill, especially in the Senate.
Patrick, your view on this, and then Gordon, Dove, and Byron. Go ahead, Patrick. Especially in terms of how sort of, right, I mean, we're sending two messages, potentially flattening our spending at a time when these threats are highlighted and that some trade-offs are going to be required and the kind of messaging that might be delivering to our adversaries.
I think everybody was expecting the United States to be heavily constrained going into 2021 regardless, and that's going to continue to be the case. But there are reasons for optimism. When you think about how the Biden administration is already going about to try to build up the idea of collective economic, technological, and defense capability, that's the challenge. That's how they're going to go about trying to make sure that even if we're reducing some budgets, or at least fighting to keep the budgets the same, we're actually increasing our capability when we're working with allies and partners. I know that's optimistic, but that's still the plan. It's notable that even Taiwan, for instance, exceeded the PRC's economic growth for all of last year. China's been boasting about its economic leadership, but it was Taiwan that grew at 3% and China at only 2.3% with those numbers just in. And meanwhile, countries like India, you know, this is the third largest country in purchasing power parity. It's had a lot of challenges with reform, and yet it's looking and rebounding faster than expected. It's got COVID under control, more or less. And like Japan, and like India, and like the United States, it's hoping that digital and green technology are going to make economic development in progress, not just for the next year or two, but over the next decades. And I think that's the reason for hope.
Gordon, your sense?
Yeah, I've been saying for a while on this program that the critical first year of any change in party in an administration is the moment to look for dealing with defense as a top line issue and not as a programmatic issue. So I wouldn't be at all surprised to find that when the final top line agency numbers come out from OMB and the White House, that defense will at most grow with inflation. I think it's quite possible that it will be flat without inflation. And frankly, if that happened and you extrapolated something like $15 to $20 billion per year out of what's the current projection in the document Trump left behind, you could get close to $100 billion over 5 years just by extrapolating the numbers out over future years with that kind of initial cut. But it's going to be residual. The administration has much, much bigger fiscal fish to fry right now. They've got a huge battle going on right now to try to get the $1.9 trillion COVID relief package through Congress. I anticipate we may see in the next week that that moves from trying to cut a deal with the Republicans to being, in fact, a full push through the reconciliation process to get that done. And interestingly, just as a digression, one of the reasons that that happens, I experienced in a off-the-record conversation with a number of people who are senior Hill staff working for leadership, pushing on these issues right now, and we did that this week. And the one of the things that's really weighing in there is the emotions that the Democrats feel about a Republican Party, particularly in the House, that voted to steal the election, if you will, and cutting a unity deal with them. The sense of having been under attack and lives being threatened is palpable in very senior staff to very senior leadership in the House of Representatives. So we'll go to reconciliation, I think, more than likely to do the COVID package. But defense is going to be residual. And how will the Defense Department deal with that? A top line change of that order when they expected or projected something like 3 to 5% growth they hoped for in program. And my guess is they'll probably stretch out some programs. They'll shrink the buy on some programs. They'll take cuts in force structure. This is where I think the ground forces come into play in planning in the Pentagon, Army, Marine Corps, probably coming down to accommodate these numbers. But it's a sort of a salami slice approach, if you will, to dealing with lower numbers in the Department of Defense. We're really waiting for the FY22 defense request to begin to see a real reflection of programmatic changes.
And I know we've talked about this, and I'll just, summarize it for our audience. There is a sense that the, Gordon, you've said ground-based strategic deterrence, the replacement for the Minuteman would be a program that would come under pressure, whereas others on our team believe that the president is likely to side with the notion of a triad, although that would depend on the nuclear posture review, one of the many reviews that have already been started by the administration. Dove, give us your sense, and Byron, want to get your parting thoughts on this as we wrap the program up. Go ahead, Dove.
Well, I'm inclined to agree with Gordon and actually with Arnold Pinaro, that we're going to see at best a budget that has no real growth and doesn't account for inflation either. Whether you can get to $100 billion is an interesting question, because then you got to figure out how to get there. Obviously, as Gordon's also pointed out, the first place to start is force structure. It's the only way you can really get at the personnel accounts without affecting benefits or pay. And I think you'll see that. The F-35 is a vulnerable program. There's people on the Hill, senior people, senior Democrats, who are questioning the program and how far it should go. The ground-based strategic deterrent may not be canceled, but it could certainly be delayed. And most importantly of all, they're not going to get away with salami slicing. Maybe in the first year, but it'll be very hard to do if they want to have some significant changes. And I don't think in general they would want to cut the acquisition accounts, because that's where modernization is taking place. You don't need a large ground force to fight in Asia, for instance. General after general, secretary after secretary of defense have said that it's not a smart idea. We keep doing it, but at some point we're going to learn our lesson there. And pretty much the same in the Middle East. So you could see some cuts there. And then there's going to be another source of pressure, and that is Bernie Sanders and those on the left. But Sanders, remember, will be in charge of the budget committee. Nobody knows how much clout he'll have as a committee chairman. But he definitely represents an element of the Democratic Party that won't be happy with just cuts in inflation and a flat growth beyond that. There's going to be pressure there, whether it'll show up in the 22 budget or the 23 budget. Not entirely clear. Usually, actually, it's the second budget that shows the major turn. The first budget that appears, the 22 budget in this case, has some changes and kind of indications of where the administration wants to go. But the big one's the 23 budget. And remember, of course, the 23 budget should come into force if Congress passes it just before the 22 elections. And at that point, we just don't know how things will play out, as Todd pointed out.
I should also point out that it looks like John Tester of Montana seems to have the lead in the horse race with Brian Schatz of Hawaii to become chairman of the Senate Appropriations Defense Subcommittee. Obviously, one of the more, something important to our defense lives. The appropriator must be respected at the end of the day.
Vago, I would just point out that both sure. Tester and Schatz have major military facilities in their state. And so even though they're both far down in the list, and we've talked about this, that the Democrats decided that if you're a chairman, you're not going to be a subcommittee chairman. And Dick Durbin gave his up because he was in the leadership. Nevertheless, these two people, however far down the list they might be, and I think they're 7 and 8, they represent states that have a major defense posture defense presence
footprint.
And their footprint, I guess, is an even better word than posture or presence, and therefore are not going to be among the Bernie Sanders types wanting to cut whatever they can get a knife on.
Byron, let me go to you to wrap this up. What are your thoughts across this whole piece?
Well, maybe three things to draw on. Look, I think if you look back at the history of U.S. defense spending since the Second World War, it's very rare that it's flat for more than 2 or 3 years. There was a brief period at the end of the 1950s and again in the early 60s and then in the mid 90s. And, the point here in current dollars or more importantly, constant dollars, it's either moving up or down. So this notion that we're going to have flat for a multi-year period, I'm fine with 22 and 23. Beyond that, you move into an increasing scope of uncertainty. And I think, you could argue, as many will on this call, that on the upside, there are going to be unforeseen security events. Asia is the place everybody's focused on right now. But you tell me what Russia is going to look like in 2 or 3 years with Putin under siege from what looks like growing domestic opposition. The Middle East, as much as we've tried to disengage from it, has a very strong gravitational pull. If the Iranian negotiations on JCPO don't go well, we could be right back in that region with a longer, stronger commitment than is now envisioned. So, and then on the downside for defense, Dove has raised this a couple of times in the past, and I certainly agree with it. Interest rates are going to matter. And we are in an environment right now where it's easy to spend because interest rates are really at exceptionally low rates. 2 or 3 years from now, if that starts to change and interest outlays become a much bigger component and or you see a progressive move in the midterm election or even the 2024 election, it's going to put much more downward pressure on defense. And then the final point that I touch on, and I know Todd knows far more about this than I do, but I think it's just this, what's the mix between capacity and capability? I think it's going to be tough to cut operations and maintenance, military personnel, and equally importantly, legacy weapon systems in front of the midterm and the 2024 elections, unless DOD leadership can really make the convincing case and get the buy-in that you have to make these choices. If not, I think RDT&E and some of the next generation investment programs, unfortunately, are going to be the bill payers for this. That's the way it tends to work in the past. And I think that's extremely unfortunate given where we are in the competition with China and to a lesser extent of Russia, but with all the other technologies that are now becoming globally available, we've got to get this investment cycle right.
I want to give Todd has put his finger up asking for a word, and I want each of you to give me a 10-second take. Is domestic terrorism and the threat of it, now that we're seeing it as being a much more significant problem and constant warnings and indeed an alert from the Department of Homeland Security saying we should expect emboldened extremist groups, or I should say extremist groups emboldened by January 6th, going to act, What does that do to the budgetary dynamic? Is it something that's just a blip? Is it something that drives something more meaningful? Todd, give us your final word, your thought on that, and quickly go along the line, but no more than 10 seconds each. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm not sure that domestic terrorism is really going to move the defense budget that much one way or the other. It could very well cut against it if there's kind of a liberal backlash against militarized law enforcement. But I would just say, picking up on what Byron was talking about there, you know, even if we're looking at a projection, not a reality, but a projection of a flat defense budget, only growing with inflation in the future, because personnel costs and operating costs of force structure historically grow at a rate above inflation, about 2 to 3% above inflation, it forces you to make those painful trade-offs. What a former CSIS scholar, Kath Hicks, has called the iron triangle of painful trade-offs. And so that's what's going to be happening with this administration. They're going to have to look at serious reductions in force structure, maybe in the Army, scaling back force structure plans in the Navy and the Air Force, and taking a hard look at some of these modernization programs. And to what Gordon had mentioned before, you know, I think that they are going to take a good look at the GBSD program and as part of the nuclear posture review. But I think what they're going to find is we don't have good options there. Even delaying the program now is not really a feasible option because of what's happening to the Minuteman III fleet. So barring some sort of a unilateral reduction, in the early 2030s and going down to a dyad, we really just don't have good options on that program. We have to press ahead as best we can.
I'm going to have to impose an iron triangle on you. We look forward to welcoming Kath back to the iron triangle with the Senate's confirmation as Deputy Defense Secretary. Let's go quickly around the horn. Patrick, Gordon, Dove, Byron, does this move the budgetary needle? Yes, no, and a couple of words. Go ahead.
It doesn't move the budgetary needle. It moves more the regulatory intelligence needle in terms of authorities and how the government has to adapt to what will be an enduring domestic terror problem.
I absolutely agree with that. It's going to be more onus on the Department of Homeland Security and, frankly, the FBI, Department of Justice, to deal with this. And I think more of it will happen when you've got Matt Gaetz and Paul Gosar and Andy Biggs and Lauren Boebert and Marjorie Taylor Greene running around the country stirring up more trouble. We're heading for trouble here, and it's going to require more investment on the DHS side.
Dove?
I agree. One thing that I think people should bear in mind, the kinds of folks that Gordon just mentioned all come from deep red districts. They're not going to disappear. They're going to be around. They're going to be doing the same kind of things they're doing now, which means that you're going to see, I think, longer term growth in some of the domestic security agencies. And then as Byron quoted me, I'll quote myself back, 2 years down the pike, or 3 years, if we see interest rates rise, that's going to put more pressure on the defense budget than any of the domestic security issues.
Let me ask, as the Republican, albeit an ever-Trump Republican, I should say, Patrick, you signed the letter as well as somebody who'd served in a confirmable position in the Bush administration. How big of a sway does Donald Trump have, and how does that affect defense? We can get a deeper conversation next week, but I have to ask that because on the departure of the president from office, there were a lot of folks who were saying, oh, it's all over and the party gets to move away. I was among the people who said, I don't think he's going to lose his grip. And in fact, we'll have a, very powerful role to play. What's your sense in terms of how this affects the defense debate?
Well, I don't think we'll see the man fade unless he's got an illness or something. But the real test of it will be the 22 elections. If the Republicans hold out as well as they've held out this time, and not only in the government-wide elections, picking up all those seats in the House, but also in state legislatures and governorships, and those people are Trumpies, then we've got a longer term problem.
Byron?
I do think the domestic terrorism issue will matter for some of the reasons that have been talked about. I think that the key issue, the FBI budget right now is around $9 billion. I don't know how much it's going to cost, not just for, to beef up the FBI and its interaction with state and local law enforcement agencies. That could be another source of funding. So I think and then of course, you know, there could be more guard deployments that we see. So at the end of the day, you know, if you look at this federal budget pot, there's a tiny sliver that could go more towards domestic security issues as opposed to international ones. And I think that's going to be the issue to walk through in 2022 and beyond, 2021 and beyond.
Guys, thanks very much. Really appreciate it. Hope everybody has a great weekend. Looking forward to having you guys back on. Patrick and Todd, thanks very much for joining the roundtable, and hope you guys can join as well in the future. Thanks again.
Thank you all.
Thanks, Vago.
Thanks, Vago.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.